where they were pushing us was to get the amniocentesis, and if she had trisomy 18, to terminate. He's painting a picture for us that basically is kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy from what he has experienced.
Genetics isn't always black and white, and the emotions and decisions surrounding genetic testing can be even more complex. Welcome to Patient Stories with Gray Genetics. I'm Eleanor Griffith, a certified genetic counselor and the founder of Gray Genetics, a telehealth genetic counseling and consulting service. It seems like there are constantly headlines in the news about genetics, but few news stories focus on the patient experience. At Gray Genetics, we are collecting patient stories, your stories. Every other Tuesday, we share an interview with a patient or a genetic counselor.
It was very clear how they felt. It was very clear what they believed was logical. I think for most people, the NICU is their absolute worst case scenario. It's their nightmare. It's exactly where a new mother does not want to be, or a new father. And for us, for Doug and I, it was our best case scenario. This meant she was alive. This meant we had days with her. We had time with her.
Chelsea Spelker is the co-founder of The Stella Effect, her and her husband's new adventure and nonprofit in honor of their daughter, Stella, who was born with trisomy 18 on November 10th, 2019 and lived 39 days. She has another daughter, Adelaide, who is 3 years old and is expecting a third daughter in May 2021. Chelsea is also earning her master's degree in counseling and human development at Lindsay Wilson College and has hopes to help bereaved parents and parents to children with life-limiting diagnoses in the future. Chelsea, thank you so much for speaking with me and being willing to share your story.
Of course. Yes, I'm so excited to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Your daughter Stella was born November 10th, 2019 with trisomy 18. When and how did you learn that she had trisomy 18? Is that something that you learned before she was born? And what does that diagnosis mean?
Yeah. So, we learned that Stella had trisomy 18 at our 20-week ultrasound, which is, I think, a lot of people learn it at that stage, at that point. And we had come in for our regular 20-week ultrasound with our regular OB, and they found a couple anomalies where they found two cysts on her brain and what they believed was a cyst on her ovaries and a two-vessel cord, which basically just means that my umbilical cord wasn't getting her all the nutrients she needed. And so I already had a hunch that something wasn't exactly right. I'd never, ever, ever would have assumed it was trisomy 18 or that we would end up losing her. But we left that appointment with a lot of hope. Our doctor told us not to worry and that we were young and it was all going to be okay. And a lot of these things were very normal. And I got blood work and I was going to come back in a week to go see a maternal fetal medicine doctor and kind of do a deeper look, a level 2 ultrasound. So when I went into that appointment, the vibe was very different. The doctor, you know, is used to seeing all of this stuff. And she was, I think, kind of right from the beginning, I think she knew. And of course, looking back, like I didn't know that in that moment. I still was pretty clueless. But looking back, the things that she said to us, like she was very somber and looked upset. And, you know, I told her that I had been eating a ton to try to get nutrients to Stella because I felt like she wasn't growing. And she just looked at me and just said, oh, honey, and just walked out the door. And it was just kind of that was kind of when I knew, like, okay, this is not good. She did a full look at Stella. And I think that they had found some things with her heart. And right after that, we went to meet with the genetic counselor. And the genetic counselor is the one who kind of walked us through everything. And he was fairly certain it was going to be trisomy 18. And of course, I'm sure that a lot of people, you know, have no clue at trisomy 18, just like we had no clue. And so he's walking us through that. And he said, hey, do you know what this is? And I'm embarrassed to say now that I was like, is this Down syndrome? And, you know, because all the people really know is trisomy 21 if you haven't been in this world.
Right. If you think if there's a chromosome problem, that's what people think of. And that's what we talk about the most in genetics.
Exactly.
Too.
Yeah. It's the most common. So he was like, no, that's not it. And he explained to us what trisomy 18 is, which is similar to trisomy 21 in that there's a third 18th chromosome. And so whether it's full trisomy, partial, or mosaic, basically discussing kind of how severe it is, even that is not completely true. Like, I've seen kids with mosaic trisomy who it was pretty severe, and I've seen kids with full trisomy and they came out with very few issues. So even that's not,
not very helpful.
Exactly. But yeah, he's explaining all that to us. And, the big difference is that there are a lot more severe difficulties that our kids face, a lot more severe than trisomy 21 often. So, he's fully walking us through that and painting a picture that we learned later is not completely true. He was a very sweet guy, very nice. But I think just had never really met any of our kids, had never met any children with trisomy 18. And so all he knew were families who chose to terminate or families who chose to carry, have their child and then do no interventions. And of course, if you have kids coming out with breathing issues or with heart defects or whatever issue, then if you do no interventions, of course, they're not going to make it. And so, he's painting a picture for us that basically is kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy from what he has experienced, and says that that Stella won't walk, talk, eat, won't have emotions. I asked, is she basically going to be a vegetable based on the kids that you have met? And again, I'm kind of embarrassed for asking that question now, but you're just trying to learn at that point, and this is a world you don't know about.
Really, that strikes me as a really good question, especially as it gets at the question of whether he's met anyone, because like I'm a genetic counselor, and as genetic counselors, so many of these conditions are not common. And most of the time we haven't met someone with one of these hundreds of conditions we might be talking about.
Yeah. That's exactly what we were doing. We were just trying to figure it out. And he said that basically she would be a vegetable. And in so many words, he said that, I think that he might get fired if he said those exact words. But, he was very nice about it, but said that there was not going to be anything there. And so the doctor came in. She had gotten a text while she was sitting in the room with us and just looked down at her phone and said, yeah, she has full trisomy 18. Well, she didn't say full, but she said she has trisomy 18.
Had you done diagnostic testing like amniocentesis during your level 2 ultrasound, or how did they get that diagnosis?
Yeah. So this was the diagnosis, was from the blood work I had done a week before, whenever they had seen a couple of cysts and the 2-vessel cord. And so the blood work came back, and we actually chose to not do amniocentesis. So that's the next part of the, we sat with the genetic counselor and the doctor for a long while. And basically we felt that they were pushing us really hard to get the amniocentesis. And I think that they wanted to have that, that surety before pushing us in any direction. And it was very clear how they felt. It was very clear what they believed was logical. Of course, they said, this is your choice. This is always your choice. But where they were pushing us was to get the amniocentesis, and if she had trisomy 18, to terminate. And I'm, of course, they didn't say those words, but when you're saying your child's going to suffer, your child, this is going to be hard on your family, like siblings don't do well with this, like there's nothing there, the child's not really there. Like that, when you hear all these things, there's nothing.
It seems seems like the underlying message is, therefore, this is what you should do.
So they don't say, therefore, this is what you should do, but that's the message you're getting. And so the push to get amniocentesis never stopped. For us, we were there, I think, until around 32 weeks, and then we moved to Cincinnati. And that's a whole other part of the story. But they never once let up on trying to get us to do amniocentesis. I had one doctor who said, you know, if she has full trisomy 18, like he was much more upfront about it and just said, it's cruel. What his message was, it's cruel to do any interventions at all. Like, and one of the things he said was, do you have any clue what it's like for a nurse to have to do, to have to bring a baby back whenever they know they're not going to live? And so, he really painted a pretty harsh picture of why we should get amniocentesis and why we needed that information in order for them to argue that we shouldn't do interventions. So, yeah.
And the blood work you'd done. So it used to be that the blood work that people would get done that might suggest trisomy 18 was blood work that's been around for quite a long time. And now what I'm guessing you had done was the non-invasive prenatal screening. Yes. That's a really good screening test, but it's not quite diagnostic, which I think probably that's interesting. It's the first time I've heard this specifically, probably changes that dynamic where you get that much more pressure to do the amniocentesis because like they're looking at, okay, and therefore now we need to confirm because you don't. And there are a lot of false positives with that, even though it sounds like based on the ultrasound findings, it was looking likely.
Yeah. I mean, they were pretty sure it was trisomy 18, even without the test that we got back. And I think that with the test and with what we were seeing, for Doug and I, we didn't need a diagnosis. No matter what came out from an amniocentesis, and I know a lot of people that get amniocentesis, we didn't feel comfortable because of the way they were pushing us. And we didn't feel comfortable with the possibility of something happening. And we know it was like minuscule that we would lose her from that, but it just wasn't worth it to us because we knew for us it made zero difference in how we moved forward.
Right. You knew you were going to continue the pregnancy regardless. And some people use that information to inform plans for delivery or to let family members know or to plan differently. But in your case, it sounds like you were already kind of mentally preparing for this baby having trisomy 18.
That's exactly right. And that was before we even knew much about it. So yeah, that was a hard day, but it was, looking back, it was just such an interesting conversation because so much of what we learned there wasn't correct. A lot of it is correct, of course. Like, of course, these children really do, the survival rate really is low and they really do struggle. But there is such a huge spectrum for how these children can do. And Stella happened to be one of the kids that had a really, really good chance of doing well. And so you just can't look at the diagnosis blindly. You kind of have to look at the child as a whole. But yeah, that came later, what I learned there. We took off to, we called our parents. We had our parents call everybody. We didn't want to speak to anyone. And we took off to our favorite vacation spot. And we basically just kind of wanted peace and space to think. And so like hours after that appointment, we packed our bags, got our toddler in the car and drove 10 hours north. And it was really nice for Doug and I just to have that time to talk, to cry, to think. And we just kind of decided that we were going to enjoy the time we had. And that time didn't really change our minds on anything when it came to what we wanted for Stella. But yeah, once we got there, our whole family showed up later. This was already a pre-planned vacation, but we just left early. And our whole family showed up later and we basically just gave them instruction that we did not want to talk about it, that no one was allowed to talk about it unless we brought it up. And we just acted like this was just our normal pregnancy and we were just going to enjoy it. We were going to enjoy vacation and make memories with Stella as long as we had her. So
did you already have her name picked out at that point?
We actually didn't. So we, I already knew her name. I knew her name since the moment I was pregnant, but getting your husband to agree with that is very but once okay. once we got her diagnosis, it became a lot more it was a lot easier argument because we knew that whether we lost her, you know, in utero or whether we lost her 10 years later, that we were eventually going to lose her. And so we wanted something that was symbolic where we look up to the sky and we can think of her. Stella means star. And so, yeah, he eventually came to terms, and he loves the name, but you know how men are. They're just hard to convince until they're not.
It's hard to agree on names in general, really hard, I think, for most couples. Yes, yeah,
completely agree. But yeah, so yeah, I don't.
How did your
no, no
sorry,
go on. Ahead.
So how did your family react to that? Was it hard for them to just say, okay, we're not going to talk about this huge thing and just wait for you to take the lead?
Yeah, I think Doug and I both have been blessed with family and friends that are just kind of emotionally in tune and empathetic and caring. And they give, and this is in any case, you know, whether one of us has gone through a divorce or someone dies or we lose a job, whatever happens, like we give each other what we need. And that's what they did. I don't know if it was hard on them because they didn't show it if it was. I'm not saying that they never broke down and cried in front of us, but you know, it was, they knew what we needed and they knew what we were requesting and they respected that. And I did talk to, I was much more able to talk and discuss. You know, Doug, of course, got there, but I think he just wanted to enjoy the vacation and just, let's just be together and make memories. And yeah, I'm sure that that was hard on them. But I know that they knew that if we needed that, then that was important. Like that was just what they were going to give us. So we have definitely been blessed with family who, if we were ready to talk about it, they were there. If we didn't want to talk about it, they respected that, you know, they weren't pushing us. So I think we're lucky in that aspect of who our support system is with family and friends.
Yeah. And you have an older daughter, yeah. Adelaide. How old was she at the time?
She was one at the time and she was turning two. So we got the diagnosis in July, early July. Or it might've even been late June. It was right before July 4th. And, Adelaide was turning two in November. So when Stella was due. So she was really young. She didn't understand much.
Old enough to maybe understand you were pregnant, maybe?
Yeah, she knew that a baby was coming. She knew that she had a little sister coming. She was very excited. But if we had tried to tell her about the diagnosis, she wouldn't have understood anything. Even if we had said Stella's sick, like, you know, she's thinking, I'll just give her a kiss. You know, I'll make it better. So yeah, it really wasn't a discussion that we could have with Adelaide in the way that you would maybe do it if you had a 4-year-old or a 7-year-old. Like Adelaide now, she's 3 now, she understands so much more. If the same thing happened now, we would have to really explain it pretty well. But she understood emotions, she understood when we were upset. She just was never gonna understand that Stella, you know, had a pretty serious diagnosis. So yeah.
Right. What was your delivery like? Did you plan to deliver at a different hospital just because of what they saw going on with her heart and other concerns?
Well, that's a whole story. So I kind of think of Stella, my pregnancy, as before finding fair care and after finding fair care. And we were here in Louisville. We were trying to get a team together. Like, we didn't want to move. We wanted to be here in Louisville with our family, close to support system. But it just wasn't working out. We met with neonatologists. We met with cardiac surgeons. We tried to get a team together. And we couldn't get enough people who were on board to do interventions for Stella. And I mean any interventions. We were getting talked out of even like oxygen feeding tubes. And just because I think that in this current climate in Louisville, Kentucky, they're just not there yet. There are a lot of hospitals who are there, who understand that there's a spectrum for our children, who understand that, you know, a lot of our kids can do well. And that's just not where Louisville is yet. And there were some doctors who were fully on board and who were fighting for us and trying, but you know, you can't have two doctors on board and not not the whole team. And by the whole team, you even have to have nurses on the board. You have to have everybody who believes in it, or who is at least accepting of your wishes. And we just weren't finding that here. We met with a cardiac surge, a pediatric heart surgeon, and he was brilliant. He was willing to do surgery for us. But he didn't really understand what was happening in that current moment, which this was last year. And there was a doctor in Omaha named Dr. Hamill, who was doing a lot of heart surgeries on children with trisomy 18 and 13. And we told our surgeon about that, our hopefully surgeon about that. And he kind of chuckled at us. He was just like, that can't be true. Like, the literature, you know, everything that I have at my hands, at my disposal, tells me that there's no way those surgeries are happening, that many surgeries are happening. And I said, well, maybe it hasn't been written about because it's happening currently, like in the last couple of months. And, you know, I learned all this from a support group. So called SOFT, it's a support group. It's a support organization for trisomy, I think is what it stands for. And you know, of course, I'm being introduced to mothers from all over the world, but especially in America, from people who are getting the help that they need from their doctors. And that's kind of the turning point for us, wherever we learned, you know, where you get your care, where you seek care is so important. And, you know, I had searched the hashtag trisomy18 on Instagram, and I found this whole world of children with trisomy18 who were so happy, who were smiling, laughing, just such a joyful part of their families. And some of them were walking, you know, with help, and some of them could feed themselves, and some of them knew sign language. And it was just amazing the real world, what is out there versus what you learn in a textbook about this diagnosis. And so from there, I kind of found a lot of hope and realized we need to find someone who's willing to help us, because what we were seeing wasn't anything disastrous. You know, she wasn't missing a whole side of her heart, or, you know, like really huge things that some of our kids face. And she really just had large VSDs, and I think it was like a couple, they never really figured out exactly what it was. It was a couple of large VSDs that is very fixable in any typical child. So basically he had called Dr. Hamill, and, you know, he knew the guy. He had drinks with him. There are only so many of these doctors in the entire country. And basically found out that, yes, he's doing a lot of these surgeries, and yes, he's having some success in our children living. And so he called us back, said that, yes, our information was correct, and that he, of course, was willing to try for Stella. The timing of it was still very up in the air, but we felt good about him. We just couldn't take the chance of staying here in Louisville. So we talked to a cardiologist in Cincinnati who was just the way that they spoke about Stella was so different from the nurses that we talked to the cardiologist that we talked to. It was just night and day. And so we decided to move. And so we picked up our lives, and we had to get out of this house and rent it. And, you know, I had no clue what I was going to be doing with my job. I was in sales and at Brown & Brown doing insurance, and they were very supportive and very caring and just allowing. It was a full-time job trying to move, trying to find a doctor, trying to educate ourselves. And by 32 weeks, we moved up there just in case we delivered early, just in case we came early. Uh-huh. And
which is more common with something like this.
Yes, much, much, much more common to come early. So we were there for a long time because Stella actually still wouldn't have come. We induced it 39 weeks, and she was not ready to come into the world. But we had to come up there in order to get into Ronald McDonald House and start doing 2 appointments a week there. And then it got to a point where they were worried about me, you know, going into labor. So I'm up there with Adelaide, and, you know, juggling a toddler, very pregnant, worried I'm going to, you know, go into labor any day, going to appointments with Adelaide. Doug's still here in Louisville going back and forth working. One thing that's important to mention is that whenever we went there, we got an MRI on Stella. We got a fetal echo. We got the level 2 ultrasound there. And we had a care conference with all the doctors there. So the neonatologist, our maternal fetal medicine, the genetic counselor, the cardiologist, everybody in one room telling us what the plan was. And they, of course, tell us, you know, every single thing that, you know, could go wrong or that, you know, was what she was going to face when she was out here, including her heart defects and a couple of other smaller things. And basically, we left there with so much hope. And the genetic counselor was just giddy talking about Stella, which I had so such a different experience from what I had in Louisville. He was smiling and just like had so much hope for her and talking about how our kids are, you know, they are just proving people wrong constantly. And he was really excited because he knew that she had a chance and every other doctor there did too. Like they were pretty convinced that she was going to make it through birth. And if she did make it through birth, that she was going to do so well. Which is what ended up happening. So getting back to your original question of delivery, we ended up having an urgent C-section and we tried for a vaginal delivery for a multitude of reasons, but they were monitoring her very, very closely and her heart started to act up a little bit. And so they took me for an urgent C-section. She came out, she had a small cry. They had a whole team there ready to help. I kind of got to see her for 2 seconds as they walked her past me, and they, had to intubate her right away. And, she scored a 4 on her Apgar. And by the time that they took her from the delivery room to the NICU, she had scored an 8 on the Apgar. So she, it was just an initial, didn't do so great, but quickly picked up and did a lot better. And so I had my whole family there. We had originally been told that, no one could go back there and that, you know, there was a very limited guest list, but because of her diagnosis and the charge nurse who happened to be on that night, it's kind of up to the charge nurse who's on that night. And they allowed my whole family, Doug's whole family, to go back there 3 at a time and meet her briefly. And so that was really great. I had the whole family meet her before I got to meet her because we didn't know how long we had. And then I finally got to go back and it felt like forever, but I was like so weirdly calm waiting to go back there. I just had this like, I don't know. I just felt like she was going to be okay. And, when I went back there, you know, I got to hold her, they put her on my chest. We had been preparing for this for months and, you know, if we only have a couple of hours with her, what do we want to do? And so I had my aunt make a birthday cake for her, which she growing up made all of our birthday cakes. And, we sang her happy birthday. We had her baptized from the same minister who married myself and Doug. We had a baptismal gown that we never got on her, but it was there just in case. we had a videographer and a photographer, and it was just really special. Like everything that we could have possibly wanted if she only lived a couple hours, we were ready and prepared for, and it made her entrance into the world just so beautiful. And she was just really amazing and really special. So
did Adelaide get to meet her that early or not until later?
Yes, Adelaide did. She actually, they rolled me back there, of course, because I had just had a C-section. And so Adelaide was on there with me rolling on the bed when we very first saw Stella for the first time. So Adelaide and I met her together for the first time. And, you know, at this point, you know, Adelaide's like, what the heck is going on? What are we doing? Why are we here? You know, she's obviously confused, but the whole family's there and we're all being calm. So she's being calm. And, you know, whenever they put Stella on me, you know, Adelaide's touching her wires and touching her, you know, her tubes and, you know, obviously trying to figure it out, but overall was just so gentle with her. And we never really had to worry. Like, Adelaide is kind of naturally a caregiver and sweet and loving and empathetic. And so she was just, she just wanted to be with her. She wanted to touch her. And, you know, whenever your baby is kind of fragile in that moment, you can't allow that to happen the way that you would want to. But yeah, it was a really beautiful moment, Adelaide getting to meet her. It's one of my favorite memories ever, but I think it will continue to be one of my favorite memories for my whole life.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
And from reading some of your posts on Facebook, it seems like you had a really good experience with the NICU staff. What was that like? You were at Cincinnati Children's Hospital the whole time?
Not the whole time. So Cincinnati Children's had just opened up a portion of the hospital where you could deliver, but we decided to deliver at Good Samaritan because we were trying, the nuances of this aren't important, but we were trying for a vaginal delivery, which we couldn't do at Cincinnati Children's. You could only be at Cincinnati Children's if you did a planned C-section. Okay. So we were at Good Samaritan, which was, you know, 5 minutes down the road, and absolutely loved them. We were with the doctors there are Cincinnati Children's doctors. And a lot of the nurse practitioners, they kind of go back and forth. If I understand correctly, I saw a lot of the same doctors once we moved to Cincinnati Children's, saw a lot of the same, there as well. And so, yeah, we were at Good Sam and we had just, you're right. We had a really amazing experience. I think for most people in the NICU is their absolute worst case scenario. It's their nightmare. It's exactly where a new mother does not want to be, or a new father. And for us, for Doug and I, it was our best case scenario. This meant she was alive. This meant we had days with her. We had time with her. And we just treated the NICU like it was our home. Like it was our second home. This was, we decorated everything. You know, the NICU nurses and the doctors, they became like family to us. Like they were so awesome. And Stella knew them like she knew us, you know, like when we were around and she could hear our voice, if they were doing something like adjusting her cannula or whatever, you know, she'd calm down to my voice, but she would also calm down to her nurses' voices who she knew really well. Like they became family to us. And we met a lot of friends there too, who were still really close to, you know, if you're looking for support in the NICU, you're going to find it. And so, yeah, it was a really wonderful experience. And we trusted them. And so it was easier to sleep at night when you knew who was with your baby all through the night. Cause at Good Sam, we couldn't spend the night there. We didn't have our own individual space. So once we moved to Cincinnati Children's, it really became like a second home. We had our own room, our own TV, our own bathroom. It was a lot easier to bring Adelaide back and forth and to bring her in the room and let her actually be there with her sister. So, yeah, we had a wonderful experience at Cincinnati Children's too. I mean, just as good, just different, but absolutely just as amazing.
We'll be back with patient stories in just a minute.
We love making patient stories. And we love that we are able to provide it to you without ads or influence from corporate sponsorships. And we would really like to keep it that way. If you'd like to support our podcast, please donate to Patient Stories at greygenetics.com. That's greygenetics.com/podcast/donate.
Did she end up having heart surgery soon after she was born or other surgeries? Or how long did she have to stay in the NICU before you were able to take her home?
Well, we, with Stella, we never got to take her home. She passed away in the NICU on day 39, but she was doing so well. Like within 48 hours, she was off of, I know that they had moved her to CPAP by then. And very quickly after that, like the next day, she was moved to low flow cannula and she was showing, they had actually talked about us taking her home. Like that's how well she was doing. We were kind of planning and preparing for that. And then like a lot of our kids do, they're doing really well. And then they run into some problems. And a lot of it is heart related. A lot of it is airway related and lungs. And for Stella, her lungs were wet. And so we had a long road ahead of us, no matter what. We were prepared to be there for 6 months to a year or even past that. Because at Cincinnati Children's, they were not willing to do early surgeries, in the way that they might've done in Omaha. So we had actually called Omaha once Stella was born because we felt that her heart needed the help right then. And they agreed, like we had talked to, they have a coordinator out at Omaha who specifically works with trisomy 18 and 13. And she said that they probably would have already done the surgery by then. But, that's a really, within the trisomy 18 and 13 world, that topic is really difficult right now because there's no literature backing it up yet, backing up an early surgery. Over, you know, what you would do with a typical child. With a typical child, you wouldn't need an early surgery on a VSD. You most likely could wait, you know, 6 months to a year to get that fixed.
They'd think that would be easier on the kid to wait.
Exactly. Because the kid gets bigger. There's a lot of reasons to wait. But with our kids in particular, you know, I'm not a cardiologist, so it's kind of hard for me to speak to it, but there has just been quite a bit of success with kids who are getting the earlier surgeries because of a lot of reasons, a whole lot of reasons. It has to do with their ability to breathe is better and their ability to, like, it has to do with hypertension, developing hypertension. Our kids are just a little bit different. And I think that it's hard to make that argument without literature backing it up, without the science backing it up yet. So right. I think it's coming. I'm not saying which way it's going to go, but I know that there are doctors out there trying to figure that out. There's new data from 2017. When a child with trisomy 18 or 13 has had their heart repaired, their median lifespan is to live to 16.2 years. And so, yeah, I mean that it's absolutely worth it, and it's hard to convince a doctor these days to even do a heart surgery at all. Like the fact that we were at a place that would do a heart surgery was a big deal, and then the timing of it becomes even more difficult. We just don't know yet exactly what is correct and what is not correct. We're still kind of at that breaking point of figuring out what is best for our kids.
Right. If you'd been able to get early heart surgery for Stella, like how early was that idea? Was it like within the first month of life or second month of life, or would it only have been if she'd lived quite a bit longer?
Well, at Omaha or Cincinnati?
Well, whichever, because you said like Cincinnati that you'd have to wait longer, right? But Omaha, they would do earlier.
Yes. So at Omaha, they're doing surgeries, at 3 weeks, 5 weeks, 6 weeks, they're doing them really early. And not always, you know, they don't just jump into surgery just because they want to. They do it when they think it's needed.
Case by case.
Yes, exactly. And Cincinnati Children's, they like to wait. I think that we were more discussing around the 6 month mark, and that was just when they were guessing. You know, if we got to 6 months and Stella was still functioning and doing okay, then they would have pushed it back further, I believe. So they want the child to get as big as possible so that they have the best chance of making it out of the heart surgery as possible. So very different timelines there of what I think might have happened at either place.
Right.
Yeah. But Omaha is not the only one doing early surgeries. They just, while I was in the NICU, they had done an early surgery at UCLA. I'm very close friends with that family. They had done an early surgery at Vanderbilt. They did early surgeries at Texas Children's. And I only know this because of the support group that I was a part of, and being really, really close to those families. So, you know, you wouldn't hear about that unless you were talking directly to other families going through the exact same thing. But
right.
Yeah.
Really in the community.
Yeah.
When Stella did pass away, was it sudden? Was it a surprise? Or did you kind of have a heads up that maybe it was her last few days?
Oh, no, it was a complete surprise. And honestly, the cardiologist has talked to us. We loved him so much. You know, whenever she was a couple weeks old, he just kind of, he fell in love with her, and he said that she was just kicking ass, and she was. So it was a complete surprise. She caught rhinovirus, and she did not pass away from rhinovirus. It was just a complication that it made all the other things going on with her. We just didn't see it as much. We didn't see it as well. She actually, they don't exactly know what happened. It was very sudden. Starting at 4:30 a.m. to the time she passed away from 11 a.m. She was very fussy, like struggling. I was calling in nurses every 30 minutes. Something's going on. Something's wrong. Can we please fix this? What's going on? We need more support. And it just kept on being like, well, shift changes. You know, they would do what they could. They would up her oxygen, and they would try to work on her. But it was, you know, shift changes coming soon. Let's talk to the doctor when she's here. And of course, like that, you know, it was all standard. This was nothing that we hadn't done before. Just pushing off. Let's wait. Let's see how she's doing in an hour. But she was not okay. And I knew she wasn't okay. And it turns out that her heart, so we were on the regular NICU floor, and whenever we talked to our cardiologist afterwards, he said this shouldn't have happened. Like I said, I'm having a hard time because I know that she shouldn't have passed away that day. I know that this was all avoidable. It was very avoidable. Like someone should have seen that her heart was acting up. Mm-hmm. And he basically just said I was right, that you know, it shouldn't have happened. But looking back, it's also clear in that moment, it's not so clear, and he's completely correct.
Right.
But it was avoidable. So if she had been on the cardiac ICU floor, those nurses and doctors are, and not doctors, but those nurses are more used to looking at the monitor and seeing that something's going on with her heart. And he said that one protocol that they think that they'll be changing at Cincinnati is that if there is a child who is on the regular NICU floor, they will be then paired with nurses who are trained to read that better, to read if something is going on with the heart better. Mm-hmm. Because the only reason that we even figured it out, like Stella laid down and she was finally calm, and I put her on her belly, and I finally sat down for a minute just to catch my breath, because I thought she was okay. And a nurse practitioner ran in and said that, you know, like she wasn't okay. Like someone out there had seen on the monitors that her heart was just going wild. And it wasn't showing on the monitor in my room. Like nothing was beeping, nothing was going off. But basically the electrical firing of her heart wasn't correct. It was messing up. And so she wasn't getting blood pumped to the rest of her body. She was on different medications, and I think that it was just off. And there are other possibilities for what could have happened. But point being, you know, all the signs were there that something was happening, but the rhinovirus really kind of masked what was happening. It was really hard to tell the difference between her, just a sick baby with a virus, and something going wrong with the heart or an infection or whatever else was happening with her that we couldn't figure out. So yeah, it was very sudden, very unexpected. Everyone expected that she would be staying there, getting her heart surgery in a couple months. Getting a trach was the plan. We were going to do an airway evaluation and a possible trach, and if necessary. And everyone expected her to go home. And that was the message we were getting over and over again. She was one of the kids with trisomy 18 or 13 that just was just doing so well. It was such a surprise. Yeah. Yeah.
Had you already started preparing room for her at home?
Well, we were kind of, we were having a hard time with the idea of coming home to, because even once you bring your baby home, especially in those first couple of years, they could
get back and forth.
yes, exactly. And so we were actually discussing, you know, moving to Cincinnati. We were discussing moving home. We were trying to figure out if we could get a care team here who would support us, which I think we would have. found that.
And here is back in Louisville. That's where you are now?
Okay. Yes, exactly. So we were talking about coming home, but it wasn't ever serious enough. We knew we had a couple months to figure that out. We knew we still had a couple of big surgeries to get through before getting home. Yeah, we never got there, but we were getting ready for that for sure.
Were you able to be there when she passed away?
Yes, I was. I was there. Doug was working, and my daughter Adelaide. We actually had our mothers living with us up at the Ronald McDonald House, and my mom was there that day and was at the zoo with Adelaide. And so, which was, you know, a blessing that they were busy and doing something fun and, you know, had no clue that I was upset and they weren't there, because every other day they might've been there at that time. Mm-hmm. But she wasn't doing well. And so I didn't want Adelaide there that day. So, it happened really fast, and it was so odd. Like I asked the doctor I asked the doctor, do I need to call my husband? You know, do I need to get him here right now? And she said, just wait a little bit. Just give me a minute. I need to figure this out. I had a nurse practitioner who pulled me aside and said, call your husband right now. I don't know why she's not having you call your husband. You need to get him here right now. Mm-hmm. So I did, and I called him, and he left work right that minute. And before he even got there, she was gone. Like in the next 15 to 20 minutes, she was gone. But yeah, I got to be there, and it was as much trauma as I hold in that day, and as hard as that day is. And there are some images I'll never be able to get out of my head that are just no parent should have to experience. Mm-hmm. It was also once she was gone, it was so peaceful and lovely. And it was the very first time I got to hold her with no wires or tubes, you know, and just got to walk around the room and be with just her. And, you know, I believe in God. I'm religious. I very much felt her presence and felt God's presence. I just felt so much comfort and peace, and I knew she was okay. Yeah, that day is hard, but it's also, you know, I also have a lot of good memories with it. I have, my whole family got to come up. So of course they allowed us to break the NICU rules of only a couple people back there. And they let the whole family in. And, we had the minister there at the hospital, came up, and I can't remember exactly what she said, but she said just absolutely beautiful words. And prayed over her, and, you know, everybody got to hold her. And for some people in the family, this was the first time getting to hold her, and which is hard to even imagine. It's hard to imagine holding a child who's no longer there. Like, I think most people have a hard time picturing that, but, mm-hmm. you know, for them, it was their only time that they got to do that. And, it's not weird or strange. It's just holding your child, you know? So yeah, it was a hard, but really beautiful day at the same time somehow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did you talk to Adelaide about that? Whew. Or how did she react?
We decided, because Adelaide had already met her, we didn't want her to see her sister like that. And so we, eventually, you know, we didn't tell her that night. We were still processing. We were still trying to figure out arrangements to get Stella picked up from the funeral home. You know, like, there was a lot to get through. So we didn't say to her that night what had happened. But the next day when she went, my family took her home. My part of my family stayed back, and they packed up our room at Ronald McDonald. You know, we had our whole life there. We were living there. And we had one part of the family, actually, I think it might've been all of them doing it together for a while, but they packed up everything. And then another set of parents took Adelaide back to Louisville, and Doug and I went to a hotel in Louisville. We wanted to be wherever Stella's body was. So when she was transported to Louisville, we went to Louisville, and we stayed in a hotel, and we drank wine, and we talked about Stella all night. And just the good memories. And then Adelaide came and joined us the next morning. And, you know, we just told her that Stella was in heaven and that Stella, got very sick and was no longer with us. And of course she doesn't get that. She's just turned two. She has no clue. Like for weeks afterwards, she would say, let's go get Stella. Let's just go get her. Mm-hmm. Let's go see Stella. And so it took her a while to understand. And she finally understood that Stella wasn't coming back. And there were a couple of breakdowns where she would cry and she would miss her. And, you know, one time we were watching The Lion King and, you know, the part where Mufasa comes out from the clouds after he's passed away. And Stella, I mean, Adelaide said, there's baby Stella, it's baby Stella. And so like, mm-hmm. I think she finally understood, you know, kind of like what it means after you pass away, that you're no longer there, but you're still there. Uh-huh. And, as a child, it feels like Adelaide is much more open to Stella. She still has me sing, like every single night she asked me to sing Stella Luna to her, which is just a made up song. Of course there's a book called Stella Luna, but it's just a made up song about Stella. Uh-huh. And so this is nothing that we've ever pushed on her. We still talk about her a lot, but, you know, Adelaide is really in tune with her and really, really makes her part of her everyday life. And it's really sweet to see.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really lovely.
Yeah.
And it sounds like very different from what you like the kind of information the first gen counselor gave, like suggesting that it'd be like really terrible for a sibling to go through this.
Yeah. I mean, there's another study from 2012 that, you know, 89% of families who chose interventions, regardless of how long their child lived, had a positive thing in their life. So I think that this is the story for most of our families, regardless of how old the siblings are. And I'm not saying that there isn't trauma. I'm not saying that there isn't pain and hurt, but I am saying that these are our kids and these are their siblings and a part of the family. And it's a positive thing for every single person I personally know who's been through this.
So I was looking on Facebook before the interview and there are a few posts that I found really interesting. We're recording this at the time of when COVID-19 is kind of the main news and there are just now vaccines available. And you had some posts just related to appreciation of healthcare workers taking care of people, including people who, you know, might be refusing to wear masks, and also just the risks of COVID-19 for the immunocompromised. And you were referring to the rhinovirus before, but as being like the mm-hmm. actual cause of Stella's death, but that is the common cold, right?
Yes.
So yeah, I just love to hear your perspective on that, like given like our current climate with this and the vaccines that are just now available.
Yeah. When I wrote that post, it was really hard because you had a lot of people out there who were refusing to wear masks. I know that that's still happening, but there was a lot of pushback. And to me, when you have had such a personal experience with a child dying from a virus and you've seen your child intubated because they were sick, it's a whole different story. And it paints this picture of, to me, it is selfish to not wear a mask and to not distance and it's selfish to go to the bars and to do something that is, possibly going to kill someone else. It may not kill you, but it is going to hurt someone who is immunocompromised the way Stella was. And it was so close to the time where we had just lost Stella from the common cold. And it was hard for us not to imagine what that would have been like if Stella had been here to see people treat others this way. And to us, it was personal. You know, the decisions you're making are going to hurt someone else. They may not hurt you, but they're going to hurt someone who's immunocompromised. And that was really hard to see over and over and over again. And so that's where that post came from. I actually don't know one child, which I assume 18 or 13, who has passed away from COVID. Although I do know some who've been hospitalized from rhinovirus, just like what Stella was struggling with. So, you know, I don't know how she would have done with COVID, but that's not really the point. The point is that someone is is not going to do well with it. And our choices that we are making on an everyday basis is going to affect those people.
Right.
Yeah. And it's important. It's really important for people to think about others other than themselves, in my opinion. So,
yeah. And I'm kind of in that same vein. You had a couple posts related to equitable treatment of transgender individuals and the Black Lives Matter movement. And I just found it really interesting that you pointed out an intersection between just like having an experience that someone else hasn't had and trying to put yourself in someone's shoes. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. Well, I am a white female. My husband is a white male. We have, Stella was our very first experience with discrimination, at that level. And we learned a lot from this experience. We learned that a lot of people struggle and have pains and have difficulties in life that we may not see. And to us, what we learned a lot about is just listening to whoever it is that is having a current struggle or facing discrimination in some way, or facing prison or death or whatever might be happening due to their skin color or due to being, you know, transgender, whatever their walk in life is. We need to be listening to them. They're the ones experiencing it. And I know that there are a lot of nuances to the subject, and I know that it's more complicated than that. But from our experience, you know, if people hadn't have listened to us, if people hadn't have been willing to fight with us, then we wouldn't have met our daughter. And so much good change can happen from listening to people who are going through something really awful and going through some kind of discrimination. If we just listen and empathize and then we actually do something about it, if we don't do that, nothing is going to change. So yeah, that's what we learned a lot from Stella and kind of that experience for sure.
Did you have any experience with children with genetic conditions or special needs before Stella?
My mother was a teacher for, she was a special education teacher. And so growing up, I was definitely around a lot of kids with a lot of different things that they were facing. And, you know, I was a kid. I don't even know what the diagnoses were, what happened for most of them. I just knew that every time I walked in the door of my mother's class, they were so happy to see me, and they'd run up and they'd give me hugs and kisses, and just such special people. So that was really my only experience with anyone with special needs, before Stella.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And another thing you mentioned on Facebook was the Stella ripple effect, and just seeing what an impact Stella has had on other people. How have you seen her life impact other people?
She has had such a ripple effect on people's lives through my social media posts. So I would, you know, talk about Stella very openly. I would be very vulnerable and kind of just tell her story. And this is all ways that she has inspired me that I'm putting out into the world. And I would have people reach out from all over, from Egypt, from places in Europe, from Australia, everywhere. And they would just say, you know, I just need you to know that your story and Stella's story is really having such an impact on my life and, you know, bringing me hope through my hard time. And I had mothers reach out who had children with trisomy 18 or 13 who said that, you know, I was the reason that they chose to advocate for their child. And, you know, because of that, they had, you know, X amount of time with their kids. And I had mothers of children with trisomy 21 who reached out to me who said, you know, seeing the way that you advocated for Stella and seeing how, what a fighter Stella was and how worthy her life was of that, has really changed the way I advocate for my child. Yeah, I mean, the stories go on and on. I've had nurses reach out to me saying Stella changed their life. Her reach on other people's lives has been one of the most amazing parts of this. She only lived for 39 days, but the number of messages, like the amount of reach she has had, to bring people hope or to give them a reason to fight has been really amazing to me. And, you know, I'm not surprised at all. She was she was amazing. She was inspiring. And this was just a part of that. We actually just signed paperwork for Stella's nonprofit, the Stella Effect. And on Instagram is handle the Stella Effect org. And we are really hoping to bring education and awareness to trisomy 18 and 13, as well as helping families, NICU families and families who've experienced loss of a child and families who have children who are medically complex or who have a life-limiting diagnosis. And these are all things that we have experienced ourselves. And but we know firsthand that there are a lot of gaps to fill and there are a lot of ways that these families need help. And so we're really excited to continue on Stella's ripple effect with this nonprofit.
And you're actually pregnant again currently, right? Expecting your third daughter or third child, I should say. I don't know if it's a girl.
Third daughter. And we always knew we wanted three or four kids. And so, we're really excited. It is a very complex time once you've experienced the loss of a child. It's, a rainbow baby doesn't really give full context of what someone's going through. Although we do view her as a rainbow baby in that, it's brought so much hope to us and hope that, good things can happen. And she very much feels like a gift from Stella. It's complex. Once you've lost a child, it's really hard. Like I'm 18 weeks pregnant right now and I have a doctor's appointment actually tomorrow at the same hospital that, gave us such terrible news about Stella. And I have my 20-week, anatomy scan coming up in 2 weeks. So yeah, it's a complicated time. It's really hard to be pregnant after you've experienced loss. Like every little thing sets you off or makes you terrified that it's going to happen again. But overall, we are just very excited and feel very blessed to be pregnant again and to get to have Stella's little sister. She's about to be a middle sister, which is kind of crazy.
Yeah, I'm guessing Adelaide's pretty excited.
Yes, Adelaide's excited. She it's like she was made to have little sisters or little brothers. She's constantly carrying around babies and taking care of them and giving them bottles, putting them to bed. We have a new niece in our family who we are able to see because they're isolating the way that we're isolating. And she's obsessed with her and takes care of her. And so I'm excited to see Adelaide be able to put that same love that she puts towards her baby dolls and her niece to her own sibling here on earth. It's going to be pretty beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there are quite a few genetic counselors who listen to this podcast, and probably a lot of them work in prenatal genetic counseling. Based on your two experiences with genetic counseling, what do you think it's important for genetic counselors to know when they're talking to families in general, maybe, but also specifically related to a diagnosis of trisomy 18 or a probable diagnosis based on non-invasive prenatal screening results?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that if everyone could take on the same attitude that Cincinnati has towards children with trisomy 18, then it would be, the world would be a better place. People who are going through this would have a better experience. And our genetic counselor here in Louisville, he was really sweet. But knowing the full picture and giving all of the information to the family, yes, a lot of our children aren't going to make it. Yes, you might lose your child in utero, but some of our kids do live, and this is what they look like. And let me show you this family. Let me show you, what some of the better outcomes could be. And I think preparing for both possibilities is important. I'm close friends with a lot of mothers who did experience stillbirth with their children with trisomy 18 and 13. And those children are still, those are our kids. And so I think it's important to realize that a lot of us who choose to not terminate, those are very personal decisions, and there is a lot out there to learn still. And just giving the full picture of what could happen on both sides is important. And when there is hope, like a child like Stella, who didn't have a lot of issues, like it is okay to give those families hope. It is more than okay. You know, our genetic counselor in Cincinnati was giddy talking about Stella. And that wasn't a show. That was because he's experienced other kids like her. Who've lived and who've made it. And so I think just being fully informed of the newest information and fully understanding these kids and what it looks like in real life is important rather than just what's in the textbook.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me. Really, what you're doing here is so important. So I really appreciate it.
Patient Stories is an ad-free podcast and is unaffiliated with any commercial genetic testing laboratories. We would like to keep it that way. You can now donate to Patient Stories online by going to graygenetics.com/podcast/donate. If you don't want to make a monetary donation but still want to support the show in another way, leaving a review on iTunes or sharing our episodes through social media also makes a big difference.
The information contained in this podcast does not constitute medical advice and is also not a substitute for genetic counseling. Neither Gray Genetics nor any of its guests makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the statements or any information contained in this podcast. Evaluation of an individual's personal and family health history is a crucial part of genetic counseling and any recommendations.